case for this morning, Janelle versus Park Forest, Chicago Heights School District.
May it please the court, Ms. Lovell. This case involves a situation where my client claimed that he was discriminated against based upon his race, and after he made the claim of discrimination, the reasons that were given to him for his termination suddenly changed. The first issue of the case involves a question of tolling. The position of the district court was that although my client did not discover that he was being replaced by persons of a different race and responsibilities that he previously held, that nonetheless he would not be granted any additional time, nor would the time period be told in the 300 days to file his complaint with EEOC. We feel that that's inappropriate, that the 300 days should begin to run at the time that he discovers that an unlawful act took place, not simply at the time he was terminated, because there was nothing at the time that would indicate to him that he was being discriminatorily terminated.
What do you think your best case is to support that position that you cited?
I can't remember the name of it, to be honest with you, Judge, but there was a case that we did cite where, bear with me a minute, maybe I can find that. I can't quickly find it.
All right. The reason I asked was I just didn't see a case that was quite arguing the factual scenario that you put here. And I didn't think the cases you cited were on point with, you know, the position you're taking here. Maybe I misinterpreted them.
I think we did cite a case that indicated that the time should start from the discovery of the unlawful conduct. And that was the basis of it, but I can't honestly tell you right here and now what that case was.
Okay, I had forgotten to tag it, too. That's why I asked about it.
In any event, even if the issue of tolling is not ruled on in our favor, the issue of discrimination still is at hand because this was an action filed under 1981 in addition to Title VII. And there's no quarrel that the 1981 action was timely. And the same standards apply. My client belonged to a protected class and had suffered adverse action. The only two issues in the prima facie case that were at odds was whether he was meeting legitimate expectations or whether similarly situated white employees were treated differently. With regard to the meeting legitimate expectations, as late as March of 1998, which is the same month that my client received notice that he was being terminated, he was advised by the person who would be his supervisor, Superintendent Reynolds, that he was doing an excellent job. Despite that, the court felt that because we had attached commendations and an evaluation that indicated he also was doing an excellent job at an earlier time, that the court felt that that did not support that he was legitimately living up to expectations at the time of his termination. Well, even if that were true, the statement, which is uncontested, by the superintendent that he was doing an excellent job in March of 1998 certainly does. So we feel that he was, in fact, meeting legitimate expectations. In addition, at one point, the matter is characterized because of my client's being listed as an administrator, that therefore he's in a different position than others who were involved in a RIF. But, in fact, we pointed out that a Caucasian administrator, Ms. Eisenbart, did not receive the same treatment, didn't even receive notices of termination until after my client and another black administrator had received notices of that they're being terminated. And, in fact, it was never even characterized as a RIF, that this was revisionist history that took place after my client filed complaints of discrimination, that they suddenly characterized all this as a RIF. In addition, the revisionist history that took place was that after my client filed complaints of discrimination, suddenly, although before he was doing excellent performance, now he was deficient in performance. So we believe that we've set out a prima facie case. Obviously, the next level that you go on then is to determine whether there's been a legitimate justification that's been issued for his termination. Well, the so-called legitimate explanation that was given is like a bouncing ball. At one point, the argument is that it simply was needed for budget cuts. My client was told if he could find appropriate budget cuts and would take on additional responsibilities, he could keep his position. He did that and he still was terminated. At another point, later after my client filed a complaint of discrimination, it's described as a riff. But my client received his notice of termination alone prior to the time that anyone else got any notices of any terminations at all. And then lastly, we had this argument that my client wasn't performing up to par. But again, all of the evidence shows that my client was in fact performing up till March of the same year he was terminated, the same month that he was terminated. So there clearly were issues that a jury could look at and determine not only that my client had established a prima facie case, but that any justification that the board tried to make for the action that it took, in fact, was mounted on, you know, even the judge admitted, was inconsistent statements. And what we submit are simply lies. You can't have it both ways. You can't honorably dismiss him saying that he's done a fine job, and then at the same time saying, actually, you did a raunchy job. You were pretty terrible in what you were performing. And if you do that, then you run the risk that's pointed out in St. Mary's that because of your mendacity, that your justification is called into question. Because obviously, if my client meets the prima facie test and in fact shows that the reasons given for his termination are lies, then a jury reasonably can find in his favor. In addition, there were discussions by the judge about statistics that were submitted that had to do with hiring practices that occurred after my client was terminated from his position. Well, our point on that is that this is not a hiring case, this is a termination case. And so whatever statistics may exist after my client was terminated concerning hiring simply aren't relevant to this, and we pointed that out. Nonetheless, the judge used that in his analysis, and that's part of the problem. In summary judgment, you're not supposed to weigh evidence nor determine credibility, and what the judge did here respectfully was to weigh evidence, and we think that that was inappropriate. We then ask that the determination by the court be reversed and it be remanded so that my client can have a trial, and I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Congressman. Ms. Glover?
Good morning. My name is Susan Glover, and I'm appearing on behalf of the defendant appellee of Park Forest Chicago Heights School District 163. May it please the court. The school district, in addressing Mr. Andrews, first states that the school district does believe that a proper finding of untimeliness for the filing of the initial EEOC claim related to the Title VII claim was made. Your Honor, Judge Williams, you had asked what case you believe is the strongest on this point, and it's our assertion that Thalen versus Mark Big Boy, this court discussed in great length the timeliness requirements for filing of Title VII claims, and also discussed equitable tolling and equitable estoppel issues, and we would assert that that case controls here. By his own admission, Mr. Janell was notified no later than April 10th of 1998 that he was to be terminated. However, he waited 386 days to file his EEOC charge. Even if Mr. Janell did not know until the fall of 1998, when he claimed that he learned of evidence of his discriminatory discharge, he still could have immediately filed at that point and let the EEOC make a determination as to whether a finding was made. Mark Thalen versus Mark Big Boy sets forth the standard that the standard is when a reasonable person would believe that he may have had a cause of action, and that this standard is especially important in cases where a charge of discrimination must be filed, because the charging party is not required to do the investigation. Instead, it is the EEOC that does the investigation in this matter. Therefore, we do believe that the finding of untimeliness was important in this case. To go to the merits of the Title VII and also the 1981 claims, since they are parallel, I do contest Mr. Janell's statement that he had no notice that his performance was improper prior to being terminated, and that in fact the record shows that in March of 1998 he did get a performance memo sent to him asking where the technology plan that he was charged with filing was and where he stood on other matters in that. This was a follow-up memo from November of 1997, asking similar questions. So there was, in fact, evidence in the record to show that his performance was being questioned prior to his RIF. As far as the issue of statistical evidence goes, the Supreme Court has found that statistical evidence is relevant in these cases. The cases show that statistical evidence is proper to consider, and in this case, the statistical evidence is compelling. Dr. Elizabeth Reynolds, who was the superintendent who made his initial determination as his initial recommendation to the Board of Education to terminate Mr. Janelle, was African American. The constituency of the school board at that time was a 4-3 African American board. Additionally, the overwhelming number of the administrators and staff in the district is African American. Therefore, we believe that the statistical evidence is relevant in this matter. Additionally, in regard to the prima facie case, there is evidence that was not contested that that there was no replacement for Mr. Janelle. The two individuals that Mr. Janelle points to as his replacements were Mr. Mike Nicolai and Mr. Bob Thomas. Mr. Nicolai and Mr. Thomas both testified, and it's uncontested, that they were only shared 6 of his tasks under the 21 tasks listed in Mr. Janelle's job descriptions. The remainder of those tasks were taken under the guise of Dr. Reynolds, who was the superintendent in this matter, and those are the administrative tasks. The 6 tasks that were taken under by Mr. Nicolai and Mr. Thomas all dealt with technical aspects, as they testified to, of the actual technology portions of the classroom. They were not administrative. Additionally, Mr. Nicolai was a teacher working on a teacher's salary schedule, and Mr. Thomas was working on an early retirement program, which brought retired teachers back into the classroom on a part-time basis to help the district. It's uncontested, however, that Mr. Janelle was an administrator working in an administrative contract, and that administrative contract set him apart in a different scheme of classification from Mr. Nicolai and Mr. Thomas. In regard to the issue of whether he was improperly RIFed, the school code sets forth different timelines for RIFs. Administrative employees must be given notice of a RIF prior to non-administrative employees. So there is no question as to whether this RIF was made up after the fact, because other individuals were RIFed, given notice of the RIF after Mr. Janelle. Additionally, in the RIF that year, there were 17 employees who were RIFed. 12 of those employees were white or Caucasian. The other 5 were African American. So the statistics again shows there that this was not shows that this was not a racially based decision. Finally, in regards to pretext and what Mr. Janelle claims are shifting reasons for his termination, the plaintiff in these matters must specifically refute the proffered reasons given by the employer to show to rebut the legitimate reasons for discharge. He must show specifically that the district lied about the explanation and that the decision, the reasons were inherently inconsistent. That is not the case here. Dr. Reynolds testified that the performance reasons led to her decision that this was a position that could be cut. The Board of Education was faced with cutting $300,000 from its budget that year. And when she testified that when she assessed the situation, his job description, he was not meeting his job expectations, and they realized they didn't need a director of technology position. They needed hands-on people in the classrooms. And that was what led to her decision that this position could be eliminated. In regards to him questioning whether that is in fact the case based on Ms. Eisenbart, who was also an administrator who was not terminated, Ms. Eisenbart's sole position was a grants administrator. And that position's sole purpose was to bring money into the school district via federal and state grants. Therefore, she was not a similarly situated individual. Finally, in turning to the Section 1981 and 1983 claims, we believe that the court correctly found that there was no municipal liability set here. Liability requires more than a supervisor taking action and the final decision then not being overturned by the final decision-making authority, and that was set forth recently by this court in the Simmons versus Chicago Board of Ed case. Dr. Reynolds was not the final decision-making authority here. She was his direct supervisor. She's the superintendent of schools. The Board of Education was the direct decision-making authority. Yet it was Dr. Reynolds about whom the plaintiff complained. All the allegations dealt with Dr. Reynolds. Therefore, the fact that the Board of Education accepted her recommendation and acted on it is not enough to establish municipal liability under Simmons. For those reasons, we would ask that the entry of the summary judgment may be upheld in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Glover. Mr. Andre?
Counsel says that there was no conflict in the evidence concerning whether or not Dr. Reynolds took into consideration the client's performance and felt that he was deficient. On page 12 of my brief, quoting from the deposition of Dr. Reynolds, the question was asked, when Mr. Duneil, when his position was eliminated, was it due to his poor performance? The answer given, no. You can't have it both ways. You can't have it that no, it wasn't a part of the performance. Performance was not a part of the decision to terminate him, as indicated in the deposition on page 35, as pointed out on page 12 of my brief at the bottom of it. You can't say that and then turn around and say, well, yes, it was. I mean, that's exactly the point that was made, that's always been made with regard to summary judgment and the issue of pretext as to it being a lie. It is a lie. I mean, one is a lie. Either he was fired based on performance or he wasn't fired based on performance, but it can't be both at the same time. And even the judge realized that and pointed out that it was inconsistent and realized that there was no way to reconcile those two. In addition, with regard to the issue of the races of the persons involved, although it's not quoted in these briefs, and the reason is because the judge never relied on that as his rationale. We did in the district court cite to the case of Castaneda versus Partido, a U.S. Supreme Court case where United States Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, in a concurrent opinion, made the point that that doesn't prevent a claim of discrimination at all. And the later cases, Uncalli cases, same-sex cases, the same-age cases, point out that the simple fact that you have someone of the same protected class doesn't mean that there hasn't been discrimination that took place. On the basis of all these, we feel that my client was entitled to have this matter taken before the jury to have them determine whether or not he was discriminated against, that they should have weighed this evidence rather than the district court, and that the district court improperly granted summary judgment. We'd ask for a reversal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Audrey. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.